And so, Mr. Chairman, we can dispense with the notion that Germany is a menace to British interests. On the contrary, were it not for the Tories, this country would be working side by side with Germany for that peace and reform that is the goal we all of us seek.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Sir Harry. Most instructive. And now I call upon that trusted leader of Australian thought, Mr. Twisden.
And that is the reason, ladies and gentlemen, that there are no Tories in Australia. Only Labour and Liberals. But I can assure you, they all believe in that great idea we call the Empire. An idea we can make work gloriously if only we put our backs into it.
Altogether, I fancy I was rather a success, although I was praying all the time there wasn't an actual Australian present. My host, who was some orphan baronet with an uncle in the cabinet, was pathetically grateful, and at last we got back to the supper he'd promised me. I'd only had two buns all day, and what with that and escaping death by inches, I was devilishly hungry. Afterwards, we went to drink grog in a cheery smoking room with a crackling wood fire, and I determined to take Sir Harry into my confidence. Despite his politics, I could see by his eye that he was a fellow to trust.
Look here, Sir Harry. You don't believe that poisonous rubbish you spouted on the platform tonight, do you?
Dear me, was it as bad as that? I suppose it might have been rather thin.
But you surely don't think Germany would go to war with us?
Ask me that question in 6 weeks, and it won't need an answer. In that bright room with the deer's heads and old prints on the wall, I told him the whole story, including the cracking of Scudder's code. I think I needed to sort it out in my own mind so that when I went to face the government with it, it would make sense. And he listened.
So you see, Karolida is going to hand in his checks on the 15th of June, and nothing in the world can prevent it.
But if they kill him...
It's going to happen, and war is coming as sure as Christmas. According to Scudder, that's been arranged since 1912.
But we aren't ready for it.
Exactly. Karolida's death will upset the Balkans, and Vienna will get mightily excited. Then Russia will chip in, only to be calmed down by Berlin acting as peacemaker.
I'm sure that there won't be war.
Their plan is to lull us into a false sense of security, then find a cause for a quarrel and let fly at us when we're least prepared. While we're talking about their goodwill and good intentions, our coast will be silently ringed with mines, and submarines will be waiting for our every battleship.
So the blacks, too.
That's the most devilish part. France and Britain have got working plans for joint action in case of war. They've been making them quietly for some time between the two general staffs. Around the time of Karolida's visit, some great swell is coming from Paris to receive nothing less than a statement of the disposition of the British Home Forces on mobilization. The Black Stone intends to get hold of these plans and then use them against us at the first opportunity. If they succeed, Sir Harry, England will be conquered within days, if not hours.
What can I do?
You said earlier you had an uncle in the cabinet. You could write him a letter. I've got to talk to somebody high up before the 15th of June.
I'll do better than that. This is Foreign Office business, and my godfather happens to be permanent secretary there. Capital fellow, name of Sir Walter Bullivant. He'll be fishing on the Kennet now. What do you want me to say?
Tell him if a man called Twisden turns up, mentions the Black Stone, and whistles Annie Laurie, he should treat him kindly.
Consider that done. What else?
You can lend me an old suit and let me look at a map. I'll make for the moors, and it'd be as well to know the lie of the land.
You shall have the pick of my wardrobe.
Thank you. And if the police come seeking me, just show them the car in the glen. If the other lot turn up, tell them I called the South Express after your meeting. Now, have your bicycle.
Daylight found me pedalling diligently up steep roads into a wide green world towards the high mountains I hoped would be my sanctuary. But around 7 o'clock, there wasn't cover for a tom-tit on those round-shouldered hills. The free moorlands were now prison walls, and the keen air was the breath of a dungeon. I chucked my bicycle into a bog and took to the heather on foot until I saw, not 2 miles off, a row of men advancing towards me like beaters at a shoot. Now, if you are hemmed in on all sides, there is only one chance of escape. You must stay in the patch and let your enemies search it and not find you. good sense, but how was I to escape notice in that tablecloth of a place? There was nothing but short heather, bare hills, and the white highway. Then, round a bend, beside a heap of stones...
Oh, confound the day I ever left the herding. Oh, there I was, my ain maester. Now I'm a slave to the government. Tethered to the roadside with serene and a back like a sickle. Oh, mercy on me, my heat's burst. Ah, the surveyor man, just report me. I'm for my bed.
He was a wild figure, about my own size, with a week's growth of beard and big horn spectacles.
What ails you, man?
Oh, the trouble is that I'm no sober. Last night my Dr. Mirren was wadded, and they danced all foul in the byre. Me and some other chills sat down to the drinking, and here I am. Oh, it's a pity that I ever look it on the wine when it was red.
Bed sounds like a good idea.
That's easy speaking, but I got a postcard yestreen saying that the new road surveyor would be round the day. He'll come and he'll no find me, or else he'll find me fool. And either way, I'm a done man.
Could you not say you weren't a whale?
Oh, I do that'll no help me, for they ken my kind and no wheelness.
Aye. Does the new surveyor know you?
Know him? Oh, no, he's just been a week at the job. He runs about in a wee motor car. Ach, he would spear the inside out of your whelk.
Where's your house?
Do near by the stream.
Now, what about your bed? I'll take on your job for a bit and see the surveyor.
Peter, man, you're the belly. Oh, it'll be easy enough managed. I'll finish that bin of stains, so you need the chap only mare this forenoon. Just tie the barra and wheel the nyuck metal for your own quarry down the road to make another bin the morn.
What name do you go by?
Alexander Turnbull. Though my friends just call me Specky, for the glasses I wear, being weak in the sect. I've been 7 years at the trade, and 20 afore that, herding on Leith and Water. Just you speak the surveyor fair, and call him sir, and he'll be fell pleased. I'll be back or midday.
Give me your hat and your glasses, in case he's heard about you.
And you tuck my coat and waistcoat.
I'd better look the part. Here, tuck my dinner and all. It is only a bite of cheese, but you're welcome to it. And the paper, though it is 6 days old.
You won't have your sleep. I'll manage fine.
By kicking my boots against the stones, I made them look a bit more like a roadman's, for I had to play the part in front of people who wouldn't miss a trick. I tied my trousers with string, rubbed dirt into my face and neck and eyes so that I looked properly bleary, and bit and scraped my fingernails till they were black and uneven. An old scout I knew in Rhodesia, called Peter Pinard, told me that the secret of playing a role was to think yourself into it. I took that wheelbarrow down to the quarry and concentrated on being an awkward cove who lived in a little riverside cottage with a bottle of cheap whiskey for company. Nothing appeared on that long white road, and I soon grew warm enough to think longingly of evening and the end of this monotony. I was so engrossed, I didn't hear the car.
Are you Alexander Turnbull?
I saw a round-faced young man in a bowler hat sitting in a little Ford two-seater.
I'm the new county road surveyor. You charge of the section from Laidlaw Byres to the Riggs. Good. A fair bit of road, Turnbull, not badly engineered. A little soft about a mile off, though, and the edges want cleaning. See to it. Good morning.
Obviously, my get-up was good enough to fool the dreaded surveyor, but my next visitors were more of a challenge. There were three men in the car, and I recognized two of them from my shelter with the literary innkeeper. The third had the look of a countryman, with eyes as bright and wary as a hen's.
Morning.
Eh?
That's a fine, easy job of yours.
There's war jobs and there's better. I'd rather have yours sitting all day in your hinterlands and lay cushions.
Oh, would you indeed?
It's you and your muckle cars that wreck my roads. We all had our rights. You should be made to mend for your brat.
Sure,
Mr. Stephen. What's he
said? My friend was just admiring your boots.
Those were never made by a country shoemaker.
Indeed, they were not.
Where did you get them?
What business is it of yours?
Oh, you can tell us. We'll no report ye.
Report me, indeed. These boots were made in London and given me by the gentleman that was here last year for the shooting.
is in order.
Let's go.
One more question. Did you see anyone pass this way early this morning?
Well,
did you or didn't you?
I wasn't out very early. You see, my daughter was married last night, and we're keeping it up late. I opened the house door about 7, and there was nobody on the road then. Since then, there's just been the baker and the road surveyor beside you, gentlemen.
Thank you, my friend. Drive on.
I continued wheeling my barrow, which was just as well, since the car returned to check up on me. Those gentry left nothing to chance. I finished my pile of stones and also my roadman's lunch, and wondered what to do next. At 5 o'clock, I decided to walk down to Turnbull's cottage to replay my own clothes and try to get over the hills in the darkness. But a few hundred yards down the road, there was another car. Its driver was occupied in trying to light a cigarette out of the wind. A sudden daftness overtook me.
Well met, my lad.
By an amazing chance, I knew the driver, Marmaduke Jopley.
Who the devil are you?
He was a sort of high-class marriage broker, an offence to creation, and the most crashing snob who'd crawl to anyone with a title.
What are you doing in my car?
You remember me, Hanny. Came to you with an introduction from Rhodesia. You were kind enough to dine me at your club.
Hanny? But good God, you're the Portland Place murderer.
Just so, and there'll be a second murder, my dear, if you don't do as I tell you.
What? What? You would...
Just give me that fine leather ulster and those driving gloves of yours, my dear fellow. And the cap, too, if you don't mind. You can have mine.
That filthy hat, I could...
Of course you could, Jopley. Why, it'll suit you. Put it on, man.
I'd really rather not.
You don't want to upset me, do you? Put it on, I say, and leave it there.
Yes. Yes, very well. There.
Very nice, my dear. You look almost human. While I, thanks to your togs, am the best-dressed motorist in Scotland...
What are you going to do?
We're going for a little ride, Marmy. You'll like that, won't you? Just sit quite still like a good little boy and no harm will come to you.
What?
Open your mouth, my child, or try even the slightest of tricks, and as sure as there's a God above, I'll wring your neck. Savvy?
I savvy.
I enjoyed that evening's ride. We passed through several villages, and I couldn't help noticing some strange-looking folk lounging by the roadside who would doubtless have had something to say if they'd recognized me. But soon we'd left villages, farms, and cottages behind, and came to a lonely moor, where the night was blackening the sunset gleam in the bog pools.
What are you doing? You're not going to kill me and bury my body in this godforsaken place.
I'm an obliging fellow, Jopley, but I don't think I'll go that far. Here you are. I'll back that old hat, if you don't mind, unless you'd rather keep it.
No, no, I'm sure it looks far better on you. Here.
Thousand thanks. There's more use in you than I thought.
You're going to stay in this wilderness? Where will you sleep?
Don't you worry about me, Chopley. I'm going to disappear. Off you go now and tell the police what's happened to you.
You can be sure of that. I promise you.
I curled up in the heather and went to sleep, thinking that, though I was not a murderer, I'd become an unholy liar, a shameless impostor, and a highwayman with a marked taste for expensive motor cars. I awoke cold and hungry. Most of my stuff was still in Mr. Turnbull's keeping, including Scudder's notebook and, worst of all, my pipe and tobacco. I thought of all the meals I'd like to eat and settled on a porterhouse steak and a quart of bitter with Welsh rabbit to follow. Then I sat up to lace my boots and saw something that put hunger out of my mind. A quarter of a mile away, spread out like a fan, was a long line of men beating the heather. Jopley had been quicker off the mark than I'd expected. I enjoyed myself playing hare to their hounds, and the luck that I'd had so far gave me the feeling that I was going to get through. But though I've got long legs and sound wind, I'm not by nature a mountaineer. And the men who had me in their sights were hefty local farmers, at a guess, who would soon shorten the distance between us. But then I came to a well-maintained road, but obviously led to a house. I took it and stopped in front of a glass veranda, through which I could see an elderly gentleman calmly watching me.
You seem a little out of breath, my friend.
He was a benevolent old fellow with a round, shiny face like Mr. Pickwick's. He stopped writing when I entered, but didn't get up. I couldn't find a word to say to him, so I just nodded towards his window, through which we could both see men half a mile off struggling through the heather.
I see. A fugitive from justice, eh? Well, we'll go into that later. I object to having my privacy disturbed by the clumsy rural policeman. Go through the hall into my study, and you will see two doors facing you. Take the one on the left and close it behind you. You will be perfectly safe. Go on.
I found myself in a little dark chamber that smelt of chemicals and had only a tiny window high up on one wall. The door had swung shut behind me like the door of a safe. Once more I had found unexpected sanctuary, but I was not altogether easy. There was something about the old gentleman which puzzled and rather terrified me. He had been too easy and ready, almost as if he had expected me, and his eyes had been horribly intelligent. Not a sound came to me in that dark place. I tried to possess my soul in patience and forget how hungry I was. Then I took a more cheerful view. The old gentleman could scarcely refuse me breakfast. I fell to thinking about bacon and eggs, half a ton of bacon and 50 eggs to go with it. While my mouth was watering, the door opened, the sunlight flooded in, and there stood my host. Have they gone, sir?
I convinced them that you had crossed the hill. I have no desire to hand over to the police a man I am delighted to honour.
As he spoke, his eyelids seemed to tremble and fall over his keen grey eyes. I suddenly remembered Scudder's terror of the man who could hood his eyes like a hawk.
I bid you welcome, Mr. Richard Hannay.
My first impulse was to throttle the old ruffian and make for the open air, but he must have sensed my intention, for he smiled and nodded towards the door behind him. Looking round, I saw two servants who had me covered with pistols. Yet, though he might know my name, he had never seen me in person. I still had a slender chance.
Who's this Hannay? My name's Ainsley.
As you wish. We shan't quarrel over a name.
I was beginning to pull myself together and reflected that at least my clothes wouldn't betray me.
I suppose you're going to give me up after all. I call that a damn dirty trick.
No, I shall not give you up, Mr. Hannay. My friends and I will have a little private settlement with you, that's all.
Oh, I wish I'd never seen that cursed motor car. Here's the money, and be damned to you.
You know a little too much, Mr. Hannay. You are a clever actor, but not quite clever enough.
For God's sake, sir, what more can I do? I've not had a bit of luck since coming ashore, at least. Everything's been against me. What's the harm in a poor devil with an empty stomach picking up some money he finds in a bust-up motor car? That's all I've done. And for that, I've been chivied and chased by those blasted bobbies all over these blasted hills. I tell you, I'm fair sick of it. You do what you like, old boy. Ned Ainsley's got no fight left in him.
Will you oblige me with the story of your recent doings?
I would, Governor, but I've not had a bite to eat for 48 hours. Give me a mouthful and something to wet my whistle, and then you'll hear God's truth.
Carl, pastéis and beer. So, proceed with your story.
I was fairly in character now. I'd even pretended to look blank when he fired a few words of German at me, so I had no trouble spinning a yarn.
I came over from Archangel a week ago, sir, to see my brother at Wigton. Being a bit short of cash, if you know what I mean, I had to go by Shanks's pony, and that's how I saw the car, sir, through a hole in the hedge.
Where was it?
About 12 miles out of Battleburn, Governor. Lying in a burn it was, and no sign of a soul. I was poking about to see what had happened, and I just happened to notice 3 sovereigns on the seat and 1 more on the floor. Well, sir, what would you do? I pocketed them, naturally. Though I wish to God I hadn't.
Go on.
Well, I tried to change one in a baker's shop, and the woman cried in the police. I thought I'd given them the slip and was having a drink from a pump when they nearly nabbed me. So up I left them holding my collar and coat, which is why I'm in this state.
You're a good liar, honey.
Just stop fooling, damn you! I'd rather have the police than you with your hannies and your monkeys with their pistols. No, Governor, I beg pardon, I didn't mean that. I'm much obliged to you for the pie and the beer, and I'll be even more obliged if you just let me go on my way to Wigton. The coast is clear.
I have no intention of letting you go. If you are what you say, you will soon have a chance of clearing yourself. If you are what I believe you to be, I do not think you will see the light much longer.
He looked steadily at me, and there was something so devilish about those eyes, something cold and clever and hellishly powerful, that I felt an impulse to throw myself on his mercy and offer to join his side. But I managed to stick it out. Just.
Carl! Im Keller! Schnell!
I sat in the chilly darkness of that cellar in a pretty miserable state of mind. No doubt the old boy had sent for his accomplices, and one of them was bound to recognize me as the roadman they'd interviewed yesterday. Once they put two and two together, what chance would I have? I thought wistfully of the police plodding after me in the wrong direction. The old devil had got rid of them pretty quickly. No doubt he had letters from cabinet ministers saying he was to be given every facility for plotting against us. That's the sort of owlish way we run politics in this jolly old country. Then I decided I wasn't going to give in without a fight. I began to explore the room, dark though it was, and I came across some sort of cupboard. I waited to see if my guards came running at the noise, but nothing happened. I felt around and found a box of matches. There was a stock of torches on a shelf. With their aid, I found all sorts of chemicals, yards of copper wire and yanks of oiled silk. But my most interesting discovery was a little wooden case. When I broke it open, I saw half a dozen little grey bricks, each a couple of inches square. Now, I'd been a mining engineer, and I knew it would only take one of these bricks to blow the whole house to smithereens. The trouble was, I couldn't remember exactly how you set the charge. I reckoned I had about a 5-to-1 chance of blowing myself into the trees. On the other hand, if I didn't get away, 10-to-1, I'd be in a 6-foot hole in the garden. It was about the beastliest moment of my life. But then I remembered poor Scudder. I'd built up a little barricade against the wall, put some explosive behind it, attached a fuse, and crouched down as far away as possible. Then I said a prayer. I think I became unconscious for a few seconds, but I managed to struggle out of the debris into the fresh air. I felt sick and ill, but I was still able to move, and I staggered blindly away from the house until I found an old stone dovecot. Somehow or other, I hauled myself up to the top, where there was a parapet behind which I could lie unseen. Then I proceeded to go off into an old-fashioned swoon. I woke with a burning head and the sun glaring in my face.
Here I
am! Nick Murphy! Fulton!
All that long, blistering afternoon as they searched for me, I lay there on the rooftop with nothing to eat or drink, praying for the coming of darkness. When night finally came, thank God there was no moon. I waited until the house was quiet, climbed shakily down, and crawled on my hands and knees, feeling every inch of the ground before me until I was sure I was clear of any alarms or tripwires. Once I was safe in the heather, I didn't stop until I had put a good half dozen miles between me and my enemies. And then the weather changed. I passed a pretty miserable night among the hills, for there were no stars to steer by, and if I wasn't sliding off rocks or tripping over heather roots, I was dragging myself out of peat bogs. I was hungry, my head ached, my shoulder hurt, and I must have looked a fine sight when I finally reached Mr. Turnbull's house.
Where are you that comes stravigging here on the Sabbath morning?
Mr. Turnbull,
Mush! Man, you're terrible done in the legs. Hold up till I get you a chair.
Good as I, like a hawk.
39 steps.
My freeze called me Spitty. 15th of June.
I cancel them.
Then I think you will see the light.
High tide, 10:17 p.m.
My ordeal had brought on a bout of malaria, something I picked up in Africa, and it was 10 whole days before I was fit again. During all that time, Turnbull looked after me like a true friend, without even asking my name. Indeed, he became downright surly when I insisted on paying him £5 for my lodging. You would have thought from our leave-taking that we'd parted in disgust, but the fateful 15th of June was fast approaching, and I had to make my way south to meet Sir Walter Bullivant of His Majesty's Foreign Office. I caught the midnight express from Moffat, and many travel-stained hours and half a dozen changes of train later, at 8 o'clock on the evening of the 13th of June, I found myself alighting at the little Berkshire station of Artenswell. I walked in a scented dusk through beech woods into a valley where chestnuts and lilac were in full bloom. Below a bridge, a huge man in untidy flannels and a wide-brimmed hat was fishing in the clear, slow stream.
Look at that big fella. £4 if he's an ounce. The evening rises over and I can't tempt him.
I don't see him.
There, yard from the reeds.
No, I've got him. You might swear he was a black stone.
Twisdon's the name, isn't it?
No. I mean, yes.
It's a wise conspirator that knows his own name. There's my house, 100 yards off. Go round to the back door. My butler will show you to your room. Dare say you could use a bath. Dinner in half an hour. You'll hear the gong.
Sir Walter did me proud, for fresh clothes were laid out for me, and we drank some good champagne with dinner. During the meal, he asked me no questions. All we discussed was sport up and down the globe. Then we went into his study, a jolly, comfortable room full of books and trophies and untidiness. I resolved to create one just like it if I ever got out of this business and had a place of my own. The coffee cups were cleared away. We got our cigars alight, and my host swung his legs over the side of his chair.
Well, I forbade my godson's instructions. In return, he promised me you'd tell me something to wake me up. I'm ready, Mr. Hannay.
I told him the whole tale from start to finish. When I'd done, he got up and confronted me from the hearthrug.